Members, we're going to get started. When we had scheduled this hearing a little over a week ago, little did we know that we would be on the floor of the House as late as we were last night, and quite a number of members were then here and stayed till about midnight for three or four major committees that were wrapping up their work. And so I suspect we'll have members continue to trickle in, but we're going to get started because we have quite a list of wonderful testifiers here today, and quite a sizable group of folks who have traveled a distance to be with us today. And so what I've done is I've scheduled the testimony so that we can hear first from our colleagues in public school districts from Greater Minnesota. I want to make sure that we for sure get their testimony in, and then we'll continue through the list. Today's discussion is about the emerging framework of persistently low-achieving schools status, which is an emerging status from the federal department that the Minnesota Department of Education is implementing here in the state. We're going to hear very quickly from our House Research staff person, Lisa Larson, in regards to this framework. What I want to do today is to have an opportunity, because we as legislators have kind of been a little bit out of the loop of this. This has emerged as part of the state's interaction with federal stimulus monies, which means our agent has really been the Department of Education in applying those funds and then meeting the criteria that come along with those funds. And so we've been out of the loop a little bit, and so this is an opportunity for legislators to hear directly from schools, from public school communities, in terms of what their experience has been relative to this framework. And so what I want to hear from them is things like what experience they've had with the Department of Education, Minnesota Department of Education, through this process. Frankly, I also want to know why they think they're on the list, persistent low-achieving schools. What are the issues that they're confronting and facing in their communities that contribute to that? And then also, if they can say a little bit about the prescribed four remedies that come along with PLA status, and whether or not those make sense to them. And obviously those could be long conversations, but the idea here is to have an opening conversation that will continue over time. So do these four remedies fit your realities and your own plans for transforming and reforming your schools? And then finally, with the Department of Education, this will be an ongoing discussion with the department. I'm interested, a number of us are interested in clarity about what obligates schools. Is it participation in the grant itself, or are schools simply obligated, regardless of their participation in the grant program or not, relative to the four remedies that are coming down from the federal government? It's frankly not clear to me where the sort of lines of obligation and authority begin and end. So with that, I'm going to start with Ms. Larson from House Research. Hi. Oh, right there is fine, Ms. Larson. Yeah, you bet.
Mr. Chairman, members, what this is a very brief summary of the Federal School Improvement Grant Program. What I want to cover in just a minute or two is talk briefly about its structure, what constitutes eligibility, what intervention models are available, how schools are prioritized, and finally the timeline for implementing this program. The program, the Federal School Improvement Grant Program, is available to state education departments, including ours, and school districts referred to in the federal grant language as LEAs, under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and also the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which is sometimes referred to as the ESEA. The Minnesota Department of Education applied for school improvement grant funds in February of 2010. It received an initial combined grant of $34 million. That grant is available to turn around 34 of Minnesota's persistently lowest achieving 5% of Title I schools. This is to be done under a three-year timeline. In applying for the grant, the department had to indicate to the Federal Department of Education how it would identify Minnesota's persistently lowest achieving schools based on rates of student proficiency and growth in reading and math, and also on high school graduation rates. This grant program is very much dependent upon the 2001 No Child Left Behind Act, which, as you may recall, imposes sanctions on schools and school districts that do not make adequate yearly progress towards student achievement targets. Just as a reminder, schools and school districts that do not make adequate yearly progress for two or three consecutive years are schools that are in need of improvement. Schools and districts that do not make adequate yearly progress for four consecutive years are in corrective action, and schools and districts that do not make adequate yearly progress for five consecutive years are subject to restructuring in a subsequent two-year process. According to a 2008 Center on Education Policy report, in 2007, 3,500 schools in the United States, or 7% of all Title I schools, were subject to restructuring under No Child Left Behind. Commentators have said that this school improvement grant program is an effort by the federal government to rapidly improve the country's persistently lowest achieving schools. Those persistently lowest achieving 5% of Title I schools identified for improvement, corrective action, or restructuring under No Child Left Behind, and Title I high schools with a graduation rate below 60% are eligible to apply to the department for school improvement grant funds. The districts that apply and receive the money are required to implement one of four school intervention models: a turnaround model, a restart model, school closure, or a transformation model. Some experts suggest that the rapid improvement that the U.S. Department of Education is seeking may make, from the standpoint of the federal government, the turnaround and restart models, the intervention models that are preferred. There are different points of view at the state level. Also, just as a point, grant programs by their very nature tend to be rather strict about their operation, and in some cases they may or may not be a perfect fit in terms of these transformation models or these intervention models. For example, some states' laws or other circumstances can preclude making all the intervention models equally available. For example, some states have a prohibition against converting schools to charter schools. In some states, including Minnesota, there is no law authorizing a state takeover. From a practical standpoint, in some locations, education management contractors that would be part of the intervention effort may not be available, or there may be too few school leaders to affect the intervention anticipated by these models. In addition, schools that provide students with targeted programs leading to high school graduation that extend beyond traditional graduation guidelines also may be poorly accommodated by this program. In terms of how to prioritize schools, the School Improvement Grant Program arranges schools into three tiers that the department has to prioritize in terms of how to allocate school improvement grant monies. Tier 1 schools are those Title I schools under No Child Left Behind that are in need of improvement, corrective action, or restructuring, and are identified by the department as one of the state's 5% persistently lowest achieving schools. Tier 2 schools are eligible for but do not receive Title I funds and are identified as among the 5% of persistently lowest achieving schools. And finally, Tier 3 schools are those Title I schools under the No Child Left Behind Act that are in need of improvement, corrective action, or restructuring, but are not in the first tier. School improvement grant funding interventions and supports may vary by tier according to the circumstances. And finally, the timeline. The school improvement grant timeline anticipates that departments, state education departments, would apply for these funds in February, that the district application process would occur during March and April, and that the State Education Agency would award these funds to districts in May to begin implementing their intervention model in the next school year.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Very comprehensive. And so with that, I'm going to ask our first, actually, I'm going to call you up in twos, if that's okay, because we have two chairs up at the witness table. Ms. Lisa Shellam, who's Principal Superintendent of Butterfield Odin Public Schools, and Ms. Jeanette Kester, who is School Board Chair of East Central School District. And if I err, if you brought other folks with me, just let me know, because it's not that I'm not trying to bother you, but please come forward. And members, we have quite a few testifiers, and so I'm going to apologize ahead of time. I'm going to push you along to get your testimony in quickly. What I would ask of members is just to hold off their questions for now. Please make your notes. If we do this right, hopefully, we'll be able to circle back with questions for folks, if we can call them back to the witness table. We do have some pressures in terms of timeline. The DFL caucus, I believe, is going to meet at 10 a.m., so we're really pushing. And I know that there are some 10 a.m. committee meetings as well that are scheduled that some of our members are going to need to scoot out to. And so I apologize ahead of time to our audience. If you see members leaving, it's not that they're disinterested. It's just that we're trying to figure out how to be at two places at one time. So with that, Ms. Shellam and Ms. Kester, I leave it to you in terms of who would prefer to go first.
I'm going to go first. Thank you all, Mr. Chairman.
And I'm sorry, the way this works is because we record our proceedings is to list, state your name for the record and then get into the testimony.
So. I am Lisa Shellam. I am the superintendent and principal of Butterfield Odin School down in southern Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman, members, and guests, I really appreciate and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today.
Welcome.
I have given you some information, but I am going to have you skip over much of it. I wanted to make sure that at some point you had information on my background as an educator. I've been with the testing program in the state of Minnesota since it was a baby in 1996. And also some demographics of our district and just some of the factors that go into our school. One of the big things is we have had some success rate with many kids. 235 total students, K-12, 107 of them are open enrolled. And a lot of them in our elementary, so we're very pleased with that. So if I could, I'm just going to go right to the meat of this and have you turn to page 14 of the packet. And this just kind of talks about turnaround school information. You did a wonderful job of recapping kind of where we're all at with this and how things were evaluated. The data obviously was used in 2006, 7, 7, 8, 8, and 9, testing data back then that we were giving to our 7th, 8th, 10th, and 11th graders. We have been identified as a Tier 2 non-funded title school in this particular area. The circumstances that surround our school as we go through this are we use this data for curriculum development. We looked at the data the best we could to drive our curriculum. School demographics, in a nutshell, our special ed population is rising. On the school report card, I believe it was like between 17% and 20%. We have families that have lived there their entire lives. They have children. They're in there. We are an unbelievable group of 14 people that sit around the table and make sure no child is left behind, and we put them in the programs that they need. We have about a 28% to 30% variable of LEP population. And those students come into us, and we make sure that they're getting ESL and doing all of the things that we need to do, plus making sure that they have breakfast and food and a place to live and all of the other things that go along with making sure that they can be educated. So we take Maslow to heart and make sure we got the bottom together before we can even get them ready to learn. So we find that very important, one of our strengths. So as we go through this document, the other thing that needs to be realized is in all of these years of data, there were four different groups of students tested each one of those years. And as different cohorts move through, I have this unusual situation of falling into the category last year of having a seventh grade class that moved in with approximately 16 students, 7 of them are in special ed, identified. My sophomore class also, excuse me, my junior class, same situation. They had 16, 17 kids, and I have 6 of them in special ed. We are proud of the fact that we've worked with agencies and said, you know what, we're doing this right. They're getting the help they need. But what's that going to do to the test data? You know, obviously, it's going to make it look a little different. I'd like to back up. 2006, 7, my only, one and only math teacher, because I have one teacher of each, was deployed. He was deployed for 22 months, the longest deployment since World War II. I couldn't find a math teacher. So I'm advertising statewide. I have nobody applying for my math position, substitute teacher in Butterfield, Minnesota. So I was fortunate enough to find a community expert that came in. She had a master's degree in science and optics. She did the best she could. We worked on classroom management. She didn't have that educational background. She did the best she could with the situation, and we supported her 100% because she became a junior class advisor, everything else that goes along with being a teacher. When he returned, we did our own data analysis and found that our kids were at least 2 years behind. In 2006-07, our junior class scored 20% higher than the state average on the high school math test. We were pleased. Our data was wonderful. 2004-05-06, we were listed as one of the Standard & Poor's top 22 academic schools in the state. And all of a sudden, my math teacher leaves, and I drop 20% that next year. The data, our data, everything fits together in a nice little puzzle. 2007-08 rolls around, and our students in Butterfield, our class of 2009, had already taken their basic standards tests. 3 or 4 special ed kids, all of them passed the reading test the first time. All of them passed the writing test the first time, 100 and 100. All of them but 2 or 3 passed the math test the first time. They were one of our highest academic classes to ever come through. What do? They decide they don't understand. They'd had 2 years of algebra geometry with someone that didn't give them the skills. They were frustrated. They said right out loud, this test is too hard. We can't do it. I've talked to the kids myself because there was a whopping 12 of them. They did not take the test. Students that scored 90-some percent in 7th grade on the MCA got a 3%. 88% got an 8. Not happy with my students. I can't help it. I didn't find out till the fall of 2008. But I want to defend them and say, you know what? 1996, our math and reading scores were at the 30th and 40th percentile. When we started as a group and I became the administrator, we were in the 75 to 100th percentile consistently. Year after year, we wouldn't be in the standards and poor lists, standards and poor if we hadn't been. And so that's year one, deployment, year two, the class, year three, the cohorts that move in with the special ed population. So we evened out. I've calculated the data along with the way the state told me to, and I'm within 2 percentage points in 2 of those years. I feel I have actually done it the way that they've done it, and I do come out with the same numbers. The numbers do not lie. But I have extenuating circumstances. The other part is now with the models that were explained. I'm the superintendent, principal, play director, transportation director, cheerleader for these students. I will be replaced as the secondary principal for 9 teachers and about 15 students next year that will not have passed because they're not in special ed or have passed because data shows already our junior class 83% of them passed the reading test already because we're back. 96 of them but 1 passed the writing test, and we have pretested them in math, and we know they're going to do well. Our sophomore class is extremely high achieving. We have our place. We have our we're back together now with our math program. But yet now I'm going to be removed as the secondary principal. I get to be the elementary principal and the superintendent. I have to hire a new principal for my 9 teachers, 15 kids, hire a turnaround officer, and hire a site administrator for my 15 kids. And I don't know what this is going to look like. And the site administrator, we've been told, now can take over all the principal's duties without an administrative license, day-to-day duties, excuse me, because the new principal coming in is only going to be in charge of instruction. So in a nutshell, I want to move on. I think I've given you one size does not fit all. We certainly were very surprised to be one of these schools, and I will tell you the last most profound piece. Our district has been in AYP one time. One time only. Our elementary, never. Our secondary, one time last spring. And with that, we got to work. Hired a math specialist, curriculum mapped. You know, I want to say we have every math standard, and I have a nice little book that I've shared. Every standard's been mapped, and we're doing summer work, and we're not going to stop because we will not leave any child behind. And these models, they do not fit us at all. And we feel like we've been kind of put in the guilty category when we know what we do. So thank you. Please take time if you haven't and read the rest of what I've prepared for you.
Thank you, Superintendent Shellam. And I was looking quickly through the handout. You found out about UPLA status through the media?
The media.
Okay.
We knew that we were on the list for the Race to the Top grant.
Yes.
Didn't understand the ramifications of that, but did not know about the SIG grants. And so I was at my desk, and my dean of students walked in, literally threw the newspaper on my desk with tears in her eyes and said the elementary staff, which there are seven of them total, were downstairs in the lounge wondering if they had jobs the next year. Mm-hmm. By the end of the day, I had students coming in saying, my mom just texted me and said our school is going to be closing next year. Immediately, I had Channel 12 call me and say, I'm coming down to do a story, and I want to tell you, the most wonderful experience of the day was talking to Pat King. I called her. She led me. She got me in touch with Commissioner Segrin, and she called me personally and really helped me through the day. So I do want to thank them because I was so shocked. I didn't even know what to say. I made it through the night. I didn't look like someone that didn't really know what was going on, but honestly, I was taken. It was a surprise to us.
I apologize for that on behalf of the state, though. That should not happen. And I suspect that Commissioner Segrin also apologized.
She did. She was terrific. So
as well.
Thank you.
Very well. So thank you, Superintendent. So Ms. Kester from East Central, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Jeanette Kester. I'm the board chair at East Central, which is a consolidated district with Sandstone and Askove, about 90 miles north of here. We're a large district of about 700 square miles and around 750 students. We're a capital loan district. We built a new K through 12 school in 2004. We built the school to hold 1,000 students, hoping if you build it, they will come, kind of thing. We learned that we were on the list on March 1st through, again, the media. It pretty much impacted the school much of the same way that that she just described. Students were upset. The first rumor that went flowing through the school was that the eighth graders did it because they had to take the MCA that year, and they must have caused the trouble because they were the ones that didn't do well on the tests, which wasn't the case. Mm. Community didn't understand. They heard poor performing, which is a term that is intended to just make people feel bad. Mm-hmm. We were just visited last week by the review team, which is Cambridge Education LLC. So we had a two-day visit where two reviewers looked at things like what's going on in the classes. They visited some classes. They did some observations of students' work. They visited with administration. They visited with parents. Just about everything having to do with the data, the outcome data, the strategies that were used, that kind of thing, and left us with a summary of their findings, recommendations on Friday. And we're quickly taking notes, and we said, when do we get your report back? And they said, well, it won't be for 30 days. And so 30 days would put us the end of May, obviously. And then we're supposed to write another grant to get the funding for the school improvement. And then on top of all of this, our superintendent is leaving June 30th. And so we're in the process of finding a superintendent. The superintendent was a K through 12 principal as well. So we're spending a lot of time, not probably not as much as you are, but we had a late meeting last night too, trying to configure how we could utilize the staff that we have currently, utilizing our best teachers as leaders in the district for curriculum. Some of the things, I'm just going to give you an idea of some of the areas of improvement that they left us with. They said lesson planning is weak. Monitoring and evaluation of teachers does not occur with regularity. The pattern seems to be to do remedial action after the test instead of before the test is given. Achievement is not being tracked and analyzed adequately. Monitoring and evaluation of learning is not taking place consistently. Planning, use of common prep times, peer observations are not being utilized by teachers. There appears to be no overall vision. A cohesive staff shares in development and evaluates itself. And it goes on and on. I'm not going to read it all. We were in statutory operating debt, just came out at the end of the school year 2009. We've been making deep, severe cuts for 3 years or longer. We, as you indicated, have a difficult time finding the teachers for the rigorous courses that are needed in the senior. And by the way, I don't know if I said this, but we were named just for our senior secondary school. We're a tier two unfunded title school as well. We had to go from a principal, a K through 12 principal, first a elementary and a senior high principal, then a K through 12 principal, and then a superintendent principal. And the other deep cuts, I think, put us in a situation where teachers didn't feel supported, didn't have the leadership they needed. I personally am pleased that we are getting some additional funding, that we will have some technical support. I feel like there's going to be opportunities for our teachers to, we'll probably possibly extend our day so the teachers have more time to talk with each other, to provide continuity in the curriculum, to come together more as a family and work together to know what the person next door to them is doing, so that we can improve the scores of those students that are struggling. I'm actually looking forward to the future, even though it's still vague. It's not clear, you know, can we do this with the turnaround officer? What things can a turnaround officer do? What things can the site, what do they call them, site manager do? All of these issues are very unclear. We're not getting direction as to what kind of qualifications does that individual need. They're not very clear at this point. So I don't know. That's my story. Yep.
Chairwoman Kester, thank you. So we're hearing some kind of emerging themes here from the first two testifiers. A sort of a not fit situation with the first one, with some real, I guess one of the common things I'm hearing is, you know, small districts that are struggling with some very real practical things that happen. You have a math instructor gets deployed, you're in statutory operating debt, which, you know, I imagine sets up a sort of escalating situation, you know, where it's hard to find the supports for teachers. Chairwoman Kester, it sounds like you're welcoming the additional resources, but there's a lot of unclarity about how any of this is going to, it's great to have resources, but, you know, how any of this is going to be filled out in terms of, you know, the specifics of applying one of the four remedies. God, there was more I was going to say, but I know Representative Faust, I'm going to violate my rule because Representative Faust is your representative, and so Representative Faust, do you have a comment or a quick comment?
Mr.
Question?
Chair, just one quick question. Ms. Kester, how many students do you have per classroom in first, second grade right now?
First, second grade.
Yeah,
About 25 to 30.
Okay. How about like 7th, 8th grade high school?
Our largest classes are almost 40. Thank we have two classes that are at 39.
Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you both, and stick around. Hopefully we'll be able to circle back. I'm going to call Eldon Sparby, who's principal of the Greenbush Middle River School District, and Shane Killen, I hope I pronounced that right, who's your board member. And then following these gentlemen will be Carl Remmers, superintendent of Castlake Bena School District. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. My name is Eldon Sparby. I am the high school principal at Greenbush Middle River School District, and we appreciate the opportunity to get to come down here and speak to you. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to our story. As the two previous ladies who testified, our story is similar but somewhat different. We were shocked that we were in this situation. We feel we have a very good school, and I'll try and explain why we thought that. We admit that we have a math score in our 11th grade that is not where we wanted it to be. We have been aware of this for 3 years, but we've been doing a good job, we felt, every year going through the data with the staff and triangulating, looking at multiple sources of data. Our data through 8th grade is excellent. It's above state average. 9th grade MAP NWA scores are above national and state average. 10th grade scores in the plan were at state average. Our ACT scores are state average. Our MCA score was bad. Couldn't figure out what the situation. This past year we made the decision we needed all new curriculum, and it hasn't been done because of the financial situation. We've replaced the curriculum starting in 8th grade. To more fit the needs of the MCA test. We had no indication that we were going to be labeled because of one test. We've been looking at all of our test scores, 7 through 12, and averaging. We always do that every year to make sure, are we at state average? If we're not, we've got a problem, and we've been there. So what has happened? We got labeled. It was a frustrating, disgusting experience. We did get a call, unlike the former testimony, we did get a call to say that we were on this list, but couldn't really explain why. It took us, took me about a week, 2 weeks to figure out why. And what's happened is, as these two former ladies testified about 7th grade scores, 8th grade scores, 10th grade, 11th grade, we're a small school of 150 students in our high school, and we're getting labeled because of one bad test. That's our 11th grade math test, which we've taken steps to correct. We've purchased new curriculum. We replaced the teacher. There's one teacher that's been responsible for the math instruction for those students. The criteria just doesn't fit us. If we'd have been allowed to be evaluated on 7 to 12 scores, it would have moved us ahead of another 160 to 70 schools in the state. We would have been right in the middle of the state where we thought we were. Because of our configuration, which happened when our two communities consolidated, we're a large geographic district 70 miles long. And for political reasons, the board back then established a middle school in one community, a high school in another community, and kept elementaries at both ends of the district so that the busing wouldn't be quite so bad. And the state at that point said, you need to be configured this way because of two different addresses. And up until this point, it's never been a concern other than financial concerns, because we have to buy two of everything when we buy something for the school. Now, I know all of the larger schools are sitting with the same situation, with only being identified with their 10th and 11th grade scores. But when you have 35 to 40 in a class, as was stated earlier, our special ed population is 18 to 20%. We do not have access to alternative learning center. We're located between Thief River and Roseau. It's 40 miles to the closest learning center. We cannot fund one financially in our own district, so sending kids to an ALC is not an option for us. We need to keep our students and try and get them through graduation. So these two factors are a real negative to us when it comes to looking at data, because we're testing every child, and you know percentages better than anybody. So it becomes a real negative situation for us. We feel that this thing has gone too fast, has not had an adequate planning. If data would have been looked at sufficiently, we would have never been in this situation. Our review was very positive. The two gentlemen from London were outstanding. They did a very thorough job, and we got the report we thought we would get. Their comments were, you have a very wonderful group of children here. You have a safe and friendly school. You have a broad and challenging curriculum. You have good teachers. Across the board, they felt we have good teachers, and they stated you have effective leadership. We don't know why we were sent here. If I had students, I would send them to your school. Direct comment from the lead assessor. We felt very good about the assessment. Very good. Our problem is we've been labeled. We really don't feel we need this. And we find there's no way out of this situation. So it's been a very negative thing. Other than the assessment, I think every school should go through that assessment. Again, because of a cost factor, every school doesn't do it. We've never done it because it's too costly. Now it's been done. We appreciated it. Staff appreciated it. But the results of it probably aren't going to make any difference.
Thank you. Thank you, Principal Sparby, and School Board Member Kylan. I apologize.
That's normal. My name is Shane Kylan. I'd like to thank the Chairman and the members for hearing me. I'm a member of the Greenbush Middle River School Board. I'd just like to put it on record that I'm not representing the board or the school district. These are my opinions. I'm not talking for the board or the school. I have two points that bother me is the four models to try and turn the schools around. It's a one fit for all schools, and my opinion is they don't work for small schools. In a small school where you have a principal or your superintendent or whoever, they're going to write up the plans to turn the school around, and the first item in the turnaround is to replace the principal. To me, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, how can you expect him to write up a plan, or anybody to write up a plan to turn your school around when it means losing his job, or anybody's job? I mean, for a small school, it doesn't fit. That was one point. And the other point is all schools are having budget problems. We've had to make cuts. We all know we're going to have to make more cuts in the future. And we were being told that we're going to get this, we need to get this funding for this grant. And we're being told if we don't accept this funding, we have the possibility of losing federal funding, being taken away from us if we don't follow these grants. Well, I feel accepting this grant money and replacing some personnel that are very good is not beneficial to our school. So as a board member, I'm being forced to decide between funding and personnel, teachers, principals that are good for our school district. And by accepting some of this grant money, we're going to put a larger burden on our teachers and our personnel and our administrators, which isn't going to be beneficial for the teaching. I guess that's where my two points were. That these models don't fit small schools. It's tough, and we're going to have to make real tough decisions on funding or personnel in a very short time to make the guidelines for this grant. And that is going to be very, very hard on our board. I guess that's my two points, short and sweet, I guess.
Thank you, Council School Board Member Kylan. Staff pointed out that the guidelines in the grant in question here states that that there should be a voluntary, so you have an option, right? And so I'll have to follow up with the information that you receive relative to what this means for participation in other federal grants to your school district. That doesn't sound like a voluntary expectation. But thank you for your testimony. I'm going to push on, members. Carl Remmers from Castlake Bena School District Superintendent, followed by Tony Simmons from the High School for Recording Arts. And members and testifiers, were about 45 minutes away from the next series of obligations that a number of our members have. And so, again, I'm just going to push, continue to push this forward. Oh, by the way, we are at a quorum, so I'm going to actually officially call us to order. And Representative Kaff, would you be so kind as to move the minutes of Wednesday, April 7th?
So moved.
There's a motion to adopt the minutes of April 7th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion approved. Superintendent Remmers, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Carl Remmers, Superintendent of the Schools of Castlake Bena. Castlake Bena is about 12, 15 miles east of Bemidji on the Leak Lake Indian Reservation. 87% of our students are Native Americans. 28% of our students are special education. We are a low-performing school. We're not arguing that. We were notified in the middle of January by Pat King that we were one of these low-performing schools by email and telephone call, and I appreciated that. 2 weeks before that, we also received word from U.S. News and World Report that our high school, the same school that was identified as low achieving, was designated as one of the 100 top schools in the nation for working with high poverty students. We were feeling pretty good at Christmas time. 2 weeks later, we weren't feeling so well. It's been stated that we have four options. All four of them are designed for large metropolitan schools, not for schools, districts that have one high school, one elementary school, a middle school. I don't have the luxury of moving principals around. I have an excellent principal. She is hardworking, dedicated to the profession, and according to the state or federal government, I must replace her. Ms. Knutson has been with us for this is her fourth year. Things have improved. We've got long ways to go. I believe that you have a letter that that I passed out earlier stating some of the things, and I'm not going to go over those. But our test scores has increased. But we have a lot of problems. We've got 13 gangs operating in Castlake area. They are recruiting younger and younger members. We have a lot of fights in school. The school is a safe place to fight. And most of our fights take place on Monday or Tuesday, and they start over the weekend, but they know that if they come to school, they can get their first punch in, and we're going to break it up by the time they, before the other person can retaliate. We've got a drug and alcohol problem. Here, 2 or 3 weeks ago, we found two of our students huffing in school. It's challenging for the principal to be an educational leader when she's constantly putting out fires. I don't know if I've ever had a better secondary principal than Pernell Knutson, in that I'm going to be forced to replace her. I'll do anything to improve student achievement, anything that will work. But I just can't understand why there isn't an option to allow good people to continue to work. Purnell's done a lot for the school. We have a youth build program of 40 kids. These kids have all dropped out of school at one time, and we got a federal grant where they go to school half-time and they go out building houses or remodeling houses the other half. We also have a Department of Justice grant. There's 17 kids in that program. They go out to Camp Rabidou, which is an old CCC camp, and they're working to restore those buildings half the time and getting their high school education the other half. So there's 56 kids each year, because we've had these programs now for 2 or 3 years, 3 years for the youth build and 2 years for Camp Rabidou, where we brought kids who have dropped out. Our dropout rate is going down, but it's still at 40%. I would invite anybody to come up and watch Ms. Knutson in action. She's at the door when the kids come in, saying good morning to them. She's in the hall. I can be sitting in their office talking to her, and the bell will ring, and she'll get up. She has to be in the hall. When I have administrative meetings, she insists that they're held at a high school, because she doesn't want to leave the building. Dedicated, extremely dedicated. We want to improve. We've got a long ways to go. Now, we've got some awfully good kids. We've got kids that is graduating this year, has got a full ride to Notre Dame, Native American girl. The tests are very hard. We have a truancy problem. Kids don't always show up. We have a large transit population. Each month, at the last day of the month, I request a list of students that are attending by each grade. And it varies. Sometimes we're at 1140, sometimes we're at 1100, sometimes we're 1070, and it goes right back up the next month again. It's very difficult for teachers to teach kids when they're not there. I'm trying to find a way, and we've got a meeting with the school board who unanimously supports Ms. Knutson. The Leech Lake Tribal Council supports Ms. Knutson. Our local Indian Education Committee supports Mrs. Knutson. And we're trying to find a way that we can keep her. I have a meeting on June 3rd between the Board of Education and the Commissioner to allow us to keep her. I've been in contact with Senator Franken to arrange a meeting with the Secretary of Education to see if they won't make an exception in our case. I've been told by Pat King that's probably not going to happen. And I think that would be a terrible waste of money for us to buy out her contract, because I have to buy her out. Her evaluations have been good. It's well past the timeline about so I could dismiss her, so I got to buy out her contract. And the money that could be used for educating students is going to go to buying out her contract. And she'll get a job someplace else, and Cass Lake will be the loser. So what I'm seeking is help from this committee to help us work with the governor, with the Department of Education to allow an exception in our case. We are getting better. We are improving. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. So, again, members, we're hearing a accounting of a, as Superintendent said, not contesting being on a PLA status. The issue really has more to do with the remedy that's being prescribed here, and specifically in terms of the removal of the principal. Members, I had offered you an article yesterday while we were on the floor of the House with other approaches in terms of turning around schools that seem to exist outside of the USDOE's four prescribed remedies, or perhaps are inclusive of them, but go beyond that. the deal with some of the drivers, I think that Superintendent Remmers identified here. We do have a quick observation from Representative Downey, and then I'm going to ask Tony Simmons and Keith Lester to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this was covered in some of the preliminary presentation, but Mr. Remmers, first, thank you. If you don't mind staying up, I have a question for you. First, thanks for your very kind of sober judgment, and it seems like reality-based assessment of what's going on and the work you're doing. I know it's got to be incredibly tough, but you made the comment that Monday is fight day and that there's this kind of cycle of behavior issues. I'm reading between the lines a little bit, and yet many of the families state that they believe the high school is a good school, and 93% state that it's a safe school. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there. But my real question for you is, as we put in these pretty strong measures, which frankly I support kind of in general and in concept, but do we also equip, have we equipped your current principal, and do we equip differently this future principal under a restructured environment with the ability to actually manage that physical environment? I mean, it just seems to me that if you can't control the physical space in your school and Monday is fight day and those kids are going to, you know, gin up over the weekend and come in and have their fights on Monday, I mean, if you can't control that, do you have any chance of turning that school around? And so my question is, do your principals and your teachers have the tools and the ability to control the environment to even try and turn it around, or are we putting a bunch of solutions, a bunch of Band-Aids on top of this cancer, which is an inability? We don't give you the ability to control your school environment to actually get the results we're asking for.
Quickly, Superintendent Remmers.
We don't have fights every Monday. They're sporadic. It is a safe school. We've got resource officers at the school. We've got hall monitors, people whose only job is to go up and walk the hall, particularly during breaks. I probably should have gave her more assistance. And if they're going to fire anybody, they should fire me, not the principal. I should have hired her a dean of students. I should have insisted we hire her a dean of students. But our finances don't always allow us to do what we should do. But yes, I should have given her more help. I should give our teachers more help.
Thank you, Superintendent. We have Mr. Simmons, Tony Simmons, and then Superintendent Keith Lester, and I believe you have Brian Bass, who's principal of your secondary. Perhaps you can pull up a chair next to the witness table there. And I think we'll, Mr. Simmons, I think we're going to start with you, and then
sure.
We'll slide over to Brooklyn Center.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to thank you for your incredible leadership on this matter. Your staff has been great, and for listening to us. These are transformational times, and I think when we think about education overall and the fact that we're in a heightened sense of accountability and we really want to improve achievement for all students, as we so-called race to the top, it's so appropriate that we take a pause and think about it. I've been listening to a lot of the testimony, and it seems clear that a lot of things are happening that doesn't really necessarily fit with our values, with our sense of what is appropriate. But they come down to us from the federal government, and there are needs for resources, and so obviously some people make a decision that this is what we need to do. But what I'm here to talk about is the fact of some of the things we think we can do. I'm the development director at High School for Recording Arts here in St. Paul, and we were founded basically and designed to work with at-risk youth by enticing them with the music business. We work with some of the most severe at-risk kids in the state, and there's been some conversation about so-called at-risk kids, and that there are schools around the country that are able to take at-risk students and turn them around and have them all go to four-year colleges and get accepted. And we think that's incredible. We know some of those schools and some of those stories. But there are different levels of at-risk youth. And in high school for recorded arts, we work with some of the most severe in the state. Like I said, over 60% of our kids are involved in the criminal justice system when they come to us. A third are homeless. But I think the most important thing to mention is that because of the design that we use with the enticement around the music business, kids come to our school, they self-select to come. And these are kids who have usually dropped out for even more than a year or two. But because they're interested in the music business, they come. They don't come to us from a parent or someone. And that makes a huge difference in terms of the fact that we use that hook to turn them around, where initially they're not that concerned about education, but then they recognize that, you know, in order to get what they want, they need to engage. So, you know, with that, we believe that there should be a lot of attention paid to this process of identifying persistently lowest achieving schools that work with this particular population and make sure that we're doing the right things to truly turn them around. Instead of re-arguing our case, because we've spent a lot of time on this matter with this body and the department, just want to talk about a couple of quick points that we believe is important. First is that if data counts, then we really need to count all of the data. And I'll explain what I mean by that later. And that when we have an opportunity to consult with schools, an opportunity to correct some things before they become a mistake, we believe that offices like the Department of Education ought to take those opportunities and really engage in collaboration, as opposed to simply saying, well, we got something prescribed to us from the federal government, we can't do anything about it, but then here we are, we're stuck with things where we know there is opportunity to have conversations. And last, why is so important that we get this right? When I say if data counts, we need to count all of the data. I gave you some of the statistics at high school for recording arts. The overwhelming majority of our students are over age, undercredited when they enter our school. That means that it would be impossible for us to reach a 60% four-year on-time graduation rate with the students we had during that three-year period that we were evaluated. And I like to mention that we are only on the list for persistently lowest achieving school for our graduation rate. With respect to the bottom 5%, where they look at test scores, actually our percentage of growth rate is over 50%. So we are outlier in terms of growth, in terms of proficiency, and we're only on it for our student population. But when we looked at that, when we found out we were going to be on this list for that, we were puzzled, and we engaged the department in a conversation that with the students who actually come to our school, it would be impossible. And we were told that, this is just what we were given. Well, you asked, well, couldn't we have had a conversation with you prior to creating this list? And that never happened. We were simply told we were on the list, and then we were in a position of having to work backwards. But then, and we were really disappointed about this, we were told that because we never restricted our population, in other words, we didn't apply for the alternative learning status within the statute that would allow us to have this particular population. That was a position the department had as to why we shouldn't necessarily get that accommodation with respect to how they saw it. And we believe that is counter to looking at data and letting data drive what we're going. Because obviously we're in this situation because of the data, our graduation rate. But if we're saying that whether or not we restrict, if the overwhelming majority of the students who come to our school are over age undercredited, and that is easily verifiable, where you could look at a MARS system and other data and you can see that, why would we not do that? Why would we ignore that data simply because we feel that perhaps some people feel that that would take them away from the conclusion that they want to reach? That is not best practices. It's not good policy. And it leads us in a direction that we believe is ultimately dangerous. So So I spoke a little bit about the consultation not happening and us not looking at data. You know, we're concerned that there should be more community conversations at the department. We're concerned with the lack of diversity in the department, that we believe it's just one step towards having someone proactively think about these local community issues and want to intuitively consult and talk with a community about them in terms of why they're important. In conclusion, I just want to say about the fact that this is really important issues, because there are a lot of prescribed remedies with respect to being on this list. And, you know, we know that we're going to have our review, and we've heard about all of the different transformational models. But it's interesting that the federal government allowed for one narrow exception to these prescribed rules, because we've heard about how virtually nothing could be done about firing a principal and all these things. But to the federal administration's credit, when they thought about the fact that certain schools might be caught up in this who serve this critical population, and that there should be a narrow exception to allow for those schools to be taken off the list on a case-by-case basis, our state chose not to do that. Our state chose not to exempt one school, as best we know. All the ALC schools that aren't on the list, from what I've heard, they just weren't on the list. They weren't exempted because they say all their test scores go back to the traditional schools. But the and this is a particular issue with the charter school community. The charter schools that happen to serve this population, whether by design or not, whether because they restrict or not, if that's simply the reality, the verifiable reality of who they are, we're being told that essentially we can't take that into consideration with respect to your reality. And we don't think that's good practice. But the administration allowed for that. And we think that they allowed for that for a very, very important reason. There was a recent article in the New York Times that said that the high school dropout rate is one of the most critical issues going on in the country. In the African-American male community in particular, a young man who doesn't graduate from high school has a 1 in 4 chance of being incarcerated. A 1 in 4 chance of being incarcerated. We need to make sure that when we look at these schools, and High School for Recording Arts is one of the most accountable, transparent schools. We've been around for 12 years. We're involved in national organizations. We invite evaluation all the time. This is not about not doing that. We are very public. We engage the corporate community. People come into our school all the time with critical lens. That is not our concern. What we're saying, though, is that prescribed remedies like this that weren't designed to fix the challenges that a school like ours has that we're meeting has to be very specifically and carefully considered. Just the other day,
Mr. Simmons, I'm sorry, I'm going to move us along. Okay. You and I have had lots of conversations about this. I do think the HSRA occupies a pretty unique nature. I know your passion.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
I know your founder's passion in your school, but we're going to have to keep pushing forward.
Well, thank you very much, Chairman. I appreciate it. I could talk about this all day, but thank you for your leadership again, and thank you to the members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Superintendent Lester and Principal Bass, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
I've visited your school. I've interacted with your school district. And I'm really anxious to hear your testimony here this morning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I just want to say that I think most of you, if you've heard me talk before, I try to remain positive. Negative things come at you, and the kids keep coming to school, so we have to stay positive. And one thing I can say today, because I am getting more irritated by some of this, is that I'm positive. This doesn't make any sense. Now, that being said, we need to improve. And I heard what you were saying, Representative.
Downer.
And I think there's a lot in there that's important, and I think that we should be looking at it. But we have this one size fits all. We, you know, pigeonhole everybody into one spot, and that doesn't make sense. And as far as blame, let me get that out of the way too. I think there's enough blame to go around. You know, we've all had a part of it. And I kind of agree with the previous superintendent. You know, if you want to fire somebody, I'm the superintendent that said, we want to make sure kids learn how to learn, they learn how to live, they learn how to function, and they learn the academics, and let's not spend so much time memorizing facts so that we can pass a test. Fire me, okay, because I caused some of that. Let me just do a quick picture of this persistently low-achieving school in Brooklyn Center. It's an IB Middle Years Program World School, two-time National Arts Magnet School of Excellence, one of the first, I was going to say first, we're about 10 minutes ahead of St. Paul with an AVID program in the state with a graduation rate of 100%. Our AYP graduation rate is 82.5%. Our mobility rate, since Mr. Bass has come, has gone from 33% to 26%. That's another piece of data that we should be looking at. We have 50% of our kids participating in after-school programs, and we're adding more programs next year to be able to support more. We have over 100 partnerships and collaboratives, relationships with different organizations to provide and assist us. We're 72% poverty. We're 35% open enrollment. And we have, in our class of 2009, 75% of them went on to post-secondary. Previous to that, our average was right in the 40, maybe 50% on a good year. This is your persistently low-achieving school, and you're hearing that all the way around here from lots of people. Keep that in mind. Keep in mind that we do need to improve, but some of these things coming down from above, and they came down from above to the State Department too. So you know it all happens everywhere. I don't know that there's a whole lot of research to dismantling your administration. If you start over, that means you need 3 more years to go ahead and do it again. And we're on a roll. You know, we're not there yet, obviously, because our scores on 3 opportunities for test with a high mobility rate, if I may, creates a problem. But we're admitting to that, and we'll fix it. I think the research on collaboration and training and coaching would be much more effective, and that's part of what's in this defined plan. Research would support research-based that are in place already. You heard from a gentleman named Mr. Simmons, I forget his organization recently, and his comment was, it's less expensive and often more effective to invest in the people already working in the schools with the right tools, he says. School staffers can produce different results. Now, he's with an organization that helped turn around Chicago schools. And Chicago schools are being touted as the place where getting rid of all the adults in the school and starting over again has been successful. They're still failing in the Chicago schools. So make no mistake, there's no support to show huge success in Chicago. No research to support firing principals. There is research to support magnets, of which we are one. You could argue that district leadership is responsible. And there are too many quick fixes out there, and I'll preach this until the day I die. We think that one thing's going to do it, you know, whatever it is. Mr. Simmons came in and he has this package. Good stuff. It's going to help prepare for tests, I believe it. But you can't say one thing. You've got kids with different personalities, different needs, different learning levels. They come to school with different levels. You need lots of approaches in order to do a good job. And singling out one or two and saying, go get them, doesn't make any sense. What really needs to happen, in my opinion, and then it'll be Mr. Bass's turn, we need to improve. We don't claim to be there. Focus professional development, parent engagement, build on quality research programs that are already in place. Remember, the solution involves more than the principal. You've got students, you've got parents, you have teachers, you have district administration. Frankly, you have the state and you have the federal government. We've had budget cuts. We've had all of these things going on. And in our case, being, as I said before, the poster child for defeated levy referenda, we've got the voters, which are the community. We need more time in school, after school and summer, not necessarily more days for everybody. Let's use the revenue to hire teachers, to get professional development, to use the money to hire librarians. We've laid off all our librarians in budget cuts. Let us use the dollars for tutoring, math, and reading support. Let us use the revenue to support leading people in curriculum and instruction and data. And then let's be proactive and don't make us start over because it doesn't make any sense. We have work to do, and I don't want to start over again. I want to start where we are and make it better. And I think that if anything less than that is not being realistic about what needs to happen. It impacts small schools more than any school. But I would argue that you can go to pretty big schools and big school districts, and you've got good principals, and you should not be getting rid of them just because. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Superintendent Lester. And I suspect we're not going to get to the department here with our time schedule, so I will say this, that I in my interactions with the department, I think that part of their intent is to apply the federal grant in such a way in which a number of those items or those strategies can play themselves out. I think what we're hearing loud and clear, though, is that how effective is it to play those out within a dominant framework of replacing your principal, turning over your staff? That seems to be a major constant theme here. Members, we have about 15 minutes left. We have about four individuals still scheduled, but we're going to continue to plow. I do want to hear from Principal Vass, because I had an opportunity to visit your school, and I'm very impressed with what you've been able to accomplish here in a very short period of time. Principal Vass.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and the members. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak, even though it wasn't on the schedule. You know, it's interesting how windy it is outside. The winds of reform, I think there's some correlation here. 24 hours ago, I was in Tampa, Florida, receiving the National Magnet School of Excellence Award on behalf of the Brooklyn Center School Community. And you may be asking yourself, what did you receive that for? You're identified as one of the 34 low-performing schools. And part of being a member of the Magnet Schools of America and receiving this grant for the last 3 years is that there is an evaluation team that comes out and identifies holistically all of the different areas in our building that we've improved. They looked at the level of student engagement. They looked at our attendance. They looked at our mobility. They looked at the different ways that the students are showing their achievement, right brain and left brain. They're looking at the art, they're looking at the iMovies, the podcast, the various ways that students are demonstrating their growth and learning, which doesn't come up in a traditional test that's looking at one possible answer. It doesn't give them credit for how they're thinking and the critical thinking that they are using when they're approaching these problems. And when they do have assessments that are looking at this piece, that are looking at the different levels of achievement, they score better. The writing test, for example, is a qualitative tool where our students are given credit. The first time, we average between 80 and 85%. Then you go to math in the eighth grade last year, we're barely at 20. There's a gap here, and we absolutely need to make sure that we're accountable for the growth that's needed. So here's the deal. We have improved in some areas of student engagement. We did have a climate that was off the hook when the youth students speak, when we got there. And that climate right now goes from 40 suspensions to less than 11 suspensions a month. You walk into this building, it is an environment where academics are respected. And we have some work to do in the area of literacy and the area of math. And so this is the place where we absolutely need support. And is the support that's needed to remove me and to bring in a new principal who does not have that context and say, here, now you fix the literacy and the math issues. We have PLCs in place. We are identifying a collaborative with the Anoka School District, and we have approached Minneapolis, and we're looking at how do we teach math to our population, because there's some serious learning challenges that are going on. Our kids are having some serious math phobia in math. And how do we approach literacy for students who are in a mobile and transient situation? And so I think to say that one size fits all, to a certain extent, we should be insulted, because it assumes that the efforts that we've put forth haven't been designed to turn around and increase student engagement and achievement. We should be insulted, because there are good principals and there are good leaders in these schools that are trying to impact change. Reform, absolutely, we need reform. We need to get curious about how we teach literacy and math. And here's another thing for us. What's happening with assessment? We're assessing skills that aren't compatible with what we're hearing that's important in the 21st century. Critical thinking, highly effective communicators, and critical collaboration, the ability to collaborate. Those are the three things that we've been driving hard on the last 3 years, and they don't show up in the assessments that we're looking at to measure student growth. So do we need a restart, or do we need growth? We need growth, and I hope that the department is able to look at and to use some common sense around which schools have leaders that are actually trying to impact change and that are not sitting here, not rolling up their sleeves and trying to impact it. We should be insulted in a one-size-fits-all, narrow-minded approach. We should be insulted.
Thank you, Principal Bass. I don't think we picked up any passion in your testimony. But thank you for the fine work that you do in Brooklyn Center. I'm going to ask Ralph Elliott, who's board chair of the Urban Academy Charter School, Bob DeBoer, who is director of New Visions Charter School, and actually I'm going to also ask Joanne Knuth to come up, just so that we're all up here quickly, so we don't lose time transitioning back and forth. And I apologize to the three of you, because you're, unfortunately, as often the case, you'll wind up, you're going to end up having to make up the time that we lost a little bit. So I'm going to ask you to be very crisp and very concise. And then again, I know that there will be members who are going to be leaving to get to 10 o'clock appointments, and so please don't take any umbrage if the members do that. I do want to finish this set of testimony, though, however. And so, Mr. Elliott, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. Very well. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Ralph Elliott. I'm chairman of the board at Urban Academy Charter School in downtown St. Paul.
Welcome.
I'd like to invite all of you at your leisure to come and visit our school and see what we are about. We're on the corner of East 7th and Robert. This is our seventh year of operation. We feel as though we're doing a good job with our students. Rather than go through a lot of change, I did write a statement and because of time, I would just like to read that.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Charter schools provide students an alternative to regular school settings. Urban Academy provides an invaluable learning environment that encompasses a holistic approach to working with the students, families, and community. It's important to recognize that a large percentage of students that come to Urban Academy face the following challenges. Sense of belonging. Many children and recent immigrants. We have children from Burma, the Thailand refugee camps, who comprise a fair percentage of our student population. And we've also received new students from New Orleans after the Katrina casualty. We have a large African American and Hmong population. We have a student population that's also 98.9% free and reduced lunch, which puts them at the poverty level. We have many students who have special education needs, behavior and academic problems that are exacerbated by multiple school transfers from regular schools within the district. Unfortunately, many students have gone from school to school to another due to homelessness, behavior issues, or new to the area. Without Urban Academy, many would have fallen through the cracks. Students have low academic performance. When they come to us, some of them are 2 to 3 grade levels behind. So when you talk about bringing someone up to grade level, it's really kind of impossible to do that in certain situations. But we do feel as though that if we are making progress, that we're doing our job. I was talking with a parent one day whose daughter is in the 5th grade and was reading at a 2nd grade level. They were on their way to Iowa. The daughter was reading the signs on the side of the road as they were traveling, and he was very surprised. And he came back and he said, you know, he said, I was listening to my daughter. He said, she couldn't read before. She was in the 5th grade and couldn't read. He said, so I'm amazed at the progress that she's made being with you. These are the kind of things that we look at that make us realize that we are on the right track. It's difficult fitting in with peers and ongoing academic problems when you're below grade level. And unfortunately, as people go on, if they haven't been taught to read, we see it so many times, they start dropping out of school. They never finish high school. By some standards, such as MCA testing, this may not be deemed as a success. But we credit it as a success. They may not make grade level, but they do show significant forward progress growth. All students have potential to learn, and we need to address their learning styles individually and collectively. In education, one size does not fit all. It is highly unrealistic to expect that we are going to bring a student up 2 to 3 grade levels within one academic year. One lesson learned in working with students who lag behind in their academic learning is that a paradigm shift needs to occur in how we interpret actual testing progress. At Urban Academy, we do utilize MAP testing 3 times yearly. MAP, which is an acronym for Measures of Academic Progress, created by educators for educators. MAP assessment provides detailed data about where each student is on their unique learning path. Currently, the student learning curve is shaped to the educational process, when in fact the educational process needs to shape itself to the student's learning curve. In our experience, this is the shift that is critical to make and assure measured success and progress toward academic achievement. Here is how Urban Academy has and will continue to address the social, behavioral, and academic needs of its students to assure that they receive a well-rounded learning and academic experience. Identify and assess the needs of the students, develop comprehensive action plans tailored to address their individual academic needs. As some of you probably already know, we did not make AYP for 2 years in a row, but before that we had made AYP. We did receive the financial award from the Minnesota Department of Education 4 years in a row after coming out of SOD a year and a half early. So we are pleased with our progress. Our authorizer, who is Urban Hamlin University, has come in. They have been pleased with what is going on and that students are making progress in their educational. Work with students at their pace and academic level. Demonstrate to students that they are respected and are capable of learning. We provide healthy foods to ensure students have proper nutrition to improve their concentration and enhance academic performance. We provide opportunities for student physical activity to increase concentration and reduce the burdens of chronic diseases such as diabetes, obesity, and in fact in 2007 we built a gym because we saw a need and we met it.
Well, Chair Elliott, I apologize, but I'm going to need to push this ahead because I know members are going to skip out and pretty soon we're going to have an empty room. So if you can just quickly wrap up and then we'll get to
Mr. We went through the review. I think we were the first school that went through it. And one of the problems that I had was that in charter schools, definitely one size does not fit all. We don't have a principal. We have a executive director, we have a site director, and we have a curriculum committee that does our curriculum. So the plans that have been put in place are really hard for us to follow, and I think this needs to be looked at and realized.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. And members, I just want to make a very quick observation that, you know, obviously we're kind of at a historical point in time, I think, where there's this heavy proper expectation that we have high expectations, that we expect high rigor, that we approach our work with a sense of urgency, there's a tension between that proper set of expectations and what are the assessment systems that we use to measure our progress, as well as what are the remedies that we then deploy either exclusively or inclusively. It seems to me that kind of gets to the rub of where we're at as a people here. Mr. DeBoer, I'm sorry, 30 seconds perhaps? I just want to really push this. Yeah.
My name is Bob DeBoer. I was the founder of New Visions. I am no longer the director, so I'm not speaking as the director for New Visions. The demographics of New Visions were K-8, 200 kids, over 90% free and reduced, 25% special ed, 35% ELL, 51% mobility. So the kids that take the third grade tests probably weren't in our school as first graders. So when you're comparing year to year to year, you're not comparing the same kids. So the use of the comparison has to be taken with a grain of salt. We were on AYP for several years. Last year we were on 9 subcategories and we got off 7 of them, which we felt was really good, and we had put into place a lot of the methods that we had learned from the department in their working with schools that are on AYP. And so we have many of the things are actually part of the turnaround strategy. We have RTI, we have extended day, we have QCOM, so many of the sub-tactics that are in the turnaround strategy we're already doing. The only other point I'd make, and it's been kind of a thread throughout people's testimony, is that the mandate for the turnaround mandate doesn't fit very well for Minnesota, mainly in small schools. Certainly the rural districts today have been real eloquent in sharing that experience. For charters, Minnesota charters on average are about 200 students. Nationally chartered schools, around 450. So we're very different than other states. Where this law turnaround model was developed was in Chicago. And in Chicago, in Illinois, charters are now LEAs. So if you read all the methods of resolution, it assumes a large district with infrastructure to replace principals, to write grants, to keep the doors open and things moving. In a small charter school with 200 kids, your options are you could be a charter, which isn't an option. You could close, which isn't an option. You could choose fire the principal up to half the staff, or you could choose to fire the principal and all of the staff. So who's going to write that proposal? Who's going to do the summer enrollment while this is all happening? I can guarantee you, if it goes through the way it is, that you're going to see with some charters financial problems because their enrollment will drop. Because those low-income families aren't going to wait around for some pie-in-the-sky people who are going to help them. They know the people they've worked with and they trust, so that it really will cause problems. I think the only other thing I would say is, which is also echoed here, is that when you're looking at a school of K-8 with 200 kids, your cell size for making these assessments of the quality of a school or teaching is very small, so it doesn't take more than 3 or 4 kids to really sway things one way or another. So, but we were doing the things that we thought needed to be done, and they were having the effect, and we want to continue to have that effect. I started a New Vision School because I thought learning to read is a civil right, and there are a lot of kids that weren't being developing and attaining those skills, and so that was why I started New Visions. And so I always have welcomed accountability and high standards, but I think we need, going to your point, Chairman Mariani, there needs to be more review looking at the testing mechanism we're using. Because when we're comparing, when they averaged our 3-year average on MCAs, that's how we got on the bad list. But, you know, so our 1 year we really made some gains was kind of negated by the average. And I think what we need to do is get to the point of measuring individuals, I mean, focusing our testing on individuals and the students' growth, rather than making some extrapolations of teacher effectiveness or principal leadership based on this student data. Because if you look at anywhere around the state of Minnesota, and this testimony I've heard before too, is that the 34 schools are heavily located in all the poor districts in the state. So there's a high correlation between poverty and the degree of poverty students in your school. So we need to look at different testing. And I know the department has tried to fight or has fought the feds on some of their models and language without success. So I really feel the only option we have is for the legislature to give the department some assistance or support to challenge this federal mandate, because if it keeps rolling the way it is, you're just going to have a whole lot more problems. And as you can hear from today, a lot of really effective people out of jobs and really, you know, starting all over.
Thank you, Mr. DeBoer. Members, if you can just hang in there for a few more minutes, I just want to hear from Joanne Knuth, who's with the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals. I do apologize because we're hoping to hear from the Department of Education. We know that St. Paul Public Schools also wanted to offer testimony, but we had hoped to have a meeting until 10:30, and unfortunately the schedule and the session disrupted that, and last-minute decisions that were made last night relative to today's schedule. So with that, Ms. Knuth, good morning.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and members of the committee. I appreciate this time. I'm Joanne Knuth, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals. I'm joined by my colleague, Fred Storti, who is the Executive Director of the Elementary Principals Association. You have heard testimony from outstanding leaders, and I'm not going to revisit many aspects of that testimony. What I'm asking you to do this morning is to look forward. We know present circumstance. We know that the unilateral implementation, I will say autocratic implementation, of a reform model without consideration of individual school circumstance does not make sense. We heard from Principal Bass, let us use some good judgment. I think two qualities of leadership, and all of you around this table are leaders, the exercise of good judgment and common sense in reaching decisions. So this is my very brief story, and then I will conclude in consideration of time. Chairman Mariani, may I ask the committee a question?
Certainly.
This is my question. Have any of you seen the video Road to Abilene?
I have not. I saw a movie with the word Abilene in it. It was John Wayne in that movie, but no.
Well, this is not the John Wayne movie. I will very briefly describe this video. I fear we are on the road to Abilene. And this is the story. A group of people sitting around in a much warmer environment than in this committee room, although I'm sure that the environment has been kind of hot sometimes here too. And they're in rocking chairs in Abilene talking about going to find something wonderful. And that something wonderful is cold, delicious, sweet ice cream in Abilene. But to get there, they have to go on this arduous journey. And it's late in the afternoon, and it's warm, and the wind is blowing. But they decide this is a good idea. We're going to get this this cold, delicious ice cream. We're going to get in this car and go on a journey to Abilene for ice cream. They do that. And everybody agrees that's a good idea. It's hot. It's late. It's a long journey, but we're going to do this, because the reward at the end will be sweet and wonderful. They go to Abilene. The ice cream store is closed. They get nothing. They drive back. And on the way back, they look at each other and say, why did we go to Abilene? Why didn't somebody stand up and say, it's late in the day. It is hot. It's a long journey. Did we think the reward was going to be so great that it would all be worth it? I fear we're on that road to Abilene. We don't know what will occur, really, with the implementation of this grant requirement. We do know that schools will deal with the aftermath for years. We do know that all the research tells us continuity of leadership is extraordinarily important to school success. Continuity of leadership in the school, continuity of teaching and learning in the classroom. So I implore you to exercise good judgment and common sense, and to ask yourselves, is that reward at the end of the day whose implementation we really don't know, but we do know present circumstance. An alternative, if we could, 2 years of implementation of a reform model with existing personnel, and we embrace accountability. After that 2 years, let's then look at the school situation and do an assessment. But please, let's not go to Abilene. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Knuth. It's always good to close with a moral story. And there's a purpose why we tell ourselves those stories. Members, I want to thank everyone for hanging in there. I also want to thank the folks who traveled great distances to be with us here today, and all the other testifiers. So I do want to, again, apologize to the department and to my own school district for not being able to get you in here. This conversation will be continued. We will continue to look for ways in which the legislature can be helpful with the executive branch relative to this framework, as well as helpful to our school districts. I think if we learn nothing here today, I think what we've learned is that there's incredible passion on everyone involved here in terms of getting this right for our students. Perhaps the big question is whether or not limiting ourselves, if you will, to the four prescribed remedies that have been sort of handed down, if you will, from Washington, D.C., should not be the wisest thing for us to do. And so we'll continue to have this conversation, and hopefully none of this conversation will ever replace our efforts and our desires to, in fact, have high expectations and high outcomes for our students in the state of Minnesota. So, members, with that, our committee stands adjourned.